Hey, everybody. Well, it's early as shit. Usually I don't get spooked out by the early morning, but this was spooky for some reason. It was very still out this morning. Also, I come outside and someone's walking their bike down the street, and it's not like it's one of those chopper bikes. And, you know, bike, I mean, not motorcycle, but bicycle. The chopper bicycle has always been fascinating to me because, like, so, you know, I'm talking about long handlebars with the smaller wheel in the front. I mean, this seems like the king of the impractical vehicles. It just seems very difficult to drive. I mean, a chopper motorcycle is not as practical as a regular motorcycle, obviously. But, you know, it looks cool, I guess. I don't find that modified motorcycles look cool at all. I guess maybe that just makes me a loser, but I'm kind of like, most of the time, like, I see those custom West Coast choppers and those, all the chopper reality shows. I don't even know if those are still on or not, but when I would see those, I kind of felt like, I mean, this bike looks shittier than it did, than, you know, just something off the floor. Something off the whatever. It's kind of like how I feel about high fashion, which is like a lot of times something that is obviously of a high fashion brand, trademark, whatever, that has marked itself as high fashion in an obvious way is usually less appealing to me than something that's just off the rack at, you know, Express or something. I don't know. I think I'm tired of people trying to stand out in these stupid ways that don't mean anything. What does it mean to me if you have a custom chopper? Well, you had some money, or have some money, obviously. But maybe not, like, maybe you just maybe you just make really bad financial decisions. I don't know. I don't get it. But anyway, there's a guy pushing a chopper bike, and it was very quiet and still, and there's just there's a vibe this morning that just was unsettling to me. Could be because I'm tired. I had to get up early as fuck again, but I got up at 5 instead of 4:30 this time because I thought that would be good, and I think it will be fine. Anyway, welcome. I have six workshops left. And I have one more of these Sunday 8 a.m.s, if I'm not mistaken. The unfortunate thing is the other Sunday 8 a.m., you know, so that's an early wake up, also is on the week of daylight savings. So that means, you know, because it's Sunday morning at like 2:30 in the morning or something is when we spring forward, which is my hated daylight savings because it's like, oh, okay. So we get robbed of an hour of sleep. This is if I was running for president, I would definitely run on the platform of daylight savings time happens at noon on Monday now, not at fucking late at night on Sunday/Saturday. Late at night Saturday, early in the morning Sunday is how I look at it. Because that's bullshit. I mean, right? Isn't that bullshit? Like, why do we lose an hour of the weekend? The weekend is short enough as it is. The work week is fucking long as fuck. And you know what? If your boss wants to be an asshole and is like, well, you gotta work an extra hour today, clockwise, fine. You know? But why can't we as a society be like, let's give ourselves a 1 hour holiday? I mean, someone was in the library the other day asking if we'd be closed for President's Day. And I was like, we will. And then I was like, I think we're closed like 6 days out of the entire year. So it's like 359 days of the year we're open. That's fucking crazy, right? I mean, that's a lot. The only ones who probably beat us are like some grocery stores and Walmart and shit that are closed like maybe Christmas Day, Christmas Eve. I mean, we do Christmas Day, Christmas Eve, Thanksgiving Day, New Year's Day, Veterans Day, and President's Day. I think that's it. We're not closed on Martin Luther King Day. They say it's because, like, well, Martin Luther King was into education, so we stay open in... Because it's sort of one of those, like, I think that's what he would have wanted, was for the library to be open so people can go to the library. I kind of think that's bullshit. I think we get away with that one because I don't think... Well, okay, we employ, like, one black person. But he's not originally from the United States either, so I don't know. I don't know if that... I'm sure that there are, like, heroes in different countries for these same sorts of things, you know? They probably have some guy in the UK who's like... I wonder who their Martin Luther King is, or if they have one. I mean, probably, right? Or someone sort of equivalent. Like, I would think most places, you know, Australia probably has their native Martin Luther King type person, right? Something. Anyway. I kind of think it's bullshit that we get away with because there's basically... I don't know. I always thought if I were black and I went to my boss and was like, I'm not working on Martin Luther King Day. Like, I'm not doing it. I feel like your boss would have to be like, it seems reasonable. I mean, what are they going to do? Argue that you should work on Martin Luther King Day? I suppose I could do it as a white guy, but my boss knows me way too well at this point to get away with that. To be like, I'm deeply offended by not having the day off. She'd be like, yeah, no, you're not. And I'd be like, you're right, because I'm the person who's like, we could be open on Christmas. How about we're open on Christmas and I take time and a half as comp time? So I'll open, I'll just run the library single-handed on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day and then take, you know, 3 days off later in the week. And it's like, no, thanks for the offer, but no. And I'm like, okay, well, that's shitty. I feel like headlights on especially raised trucks need to be, like, regulated, and they are not. Like, how bright do they have to be for you to see the road versus, like, blinding someone else? How wide do they have to go on the road? Like, do you need to illuminate the entire road? I almost ran over a rabbit last night. I was in a neighborhood. I mean, I wasn't doing anything crazy. I was just driving through a neighborhood, and it just fucking ran out in the road. I had a, like, thing of nachos on the seat next to me. That makes it sound like I had an open tray of nachos from, like, 7-Eleven, but it was a, you know, nacho dinner thing from a Mexican food place. It's in, like, a covered with foil dish. But, you know, so I, like, had to slam on the brakes to try and avoid this rabbit. I think it still went underneath my car, like, ran horizontally underneath my car. And came, but I saw it come out the other side and go running off, and I didn't feel any bumps or anything, so I was like, I think we succeeded in not hitting this rabbit, despite the rabbit's best efforts. Because, man, it seemed like that rabbit, it was just, it's like an empty road. There was nobody else really driving around there. It's not like a crowded road that it's like, fuck it, I gotta go sometime. It's a very quiet road, and he just chose to dart out right when I was going. This happened once when I was a young man. I was driving the back roads to Fort Collins, and a cat came running out of a ditch on one side, ran underneath my car between the wheels and out the other side. Seemingly untouched. I know that, like, you can hit the animal and then they, like, run off or whatever, but having run over a duck one time, I can tell you, you can feel when you hit something the size of even a small animal. So that was quite a moment. And it just pissed me off because I was like, dude, I don't want to hit you with my vehicle, but you're making it difficult for me to accomplish that very small life goal of, like, I'd rather not hit a cat with my car. Given my options, if my options are, yes, hit a cat with your car, or avoid hitting a cat with your car, I'll take not hitting the cat with the car whenever possible. And you're making that difficult for me. It's frustrating to have a modest goal, like, I'm not going to hit a cat with my car today, and a cat's working against you. So anyway, I hit the brakes for this rabbit, and then I yelled at the rabbit. I was like, you fucked up my nachos, because they went sliding off the seat, and they were upside down in the footwell, and I was just like, God damn it, rabbit. Like, why'd you do that? I saved your life, but it cost me some of the structural integrity of my nachos. I've had nachos for dinner two nights this week, because I'm getting my other gum done next week. So A, I gotta eat my crunchy foods while I can, get it out of my system. And B, I think I lost about 10 pounds last time. I think, you know, a combination of, I wasn't real hungry, I think, from painkillers. Also, you don't really want to eat. Like, there's not a lot of pleasure in eating when your gums are in, like, a lot of pain and your mouth is in pain. So I lost, like, 10 pounds. So I'm trying to, this time, I'm like, okay, I'm going to bulk up a little bit this time. Bulk up. Like I'm a bodybuilder or something. I'm just trying to, like, I figure a few extra LBs will give me something, a little cushion for the push-in of gum tissue into other gum tissue. I called the dentist. I was supposed to see the dentist on Tuesday. But I was like, well, I'm getting this gum graft done on Wednesday. So I'm going to go after that's done with. Because, so you get the gum graft, you can't brush those teeth for like a week. I mean, you're not supposed to touch them at all. So they get disgusting, you know what I mean? They get very coated and whatever. And so I called the dentist to say, hey, let's reschedule because I'm getting this thing done and here's the deal. And the person on the phone was kind of like, you know, it was the dental office receptionist. And she's like, are you sure you want to reschedule? Some people find it really beneficial to come in and get their teeth cleaned right before they get a gum graft. And I was kind of like, who are these people who are just like, oh yeah, I'll go to the dentist before. I'll get this gum graft done. I'll go back to the oral surgeon like a week later. And then, sorry, I just avoided something in the road that may have been a giant rock. I couldn't tell. Or a bag. I'll go to the oral surgeon again a week later. And then I'll go another week after that. So three trips total. Get my stitches out, get cleared for everything. And then, like, go to the dentist again. So it's like, yeah, you know, thanks for offering to turn my dental visits from 3 to 5. Or even from 4 to 5. I'm not even really trying to get out of my regular dentist appointment. I'm just trying to say, like, let's maximize the benefit. If I'm going twice a year, let's put it off 2 weeks and get our money's worth here and get our time's worth. And, like, let's have the dentist clean the teeth that haven't been cleaned for, like, forever. And she was kind of pushing back. She was like, are you sure you want to do that? And, like, a lot of people do it this way. And I was like, well, they sound like idiots. And if that's your sales pitch of, like, you know, you could go to the dentist twice to do what you got done in once, I feel like, oh, fuck off. I'm aware that I could probably go to the dentist, like, once a month if I chose. I'm sure I could find a dentist out there who's like, sure, we'll take a look once a month. But I don't want to. I don't want to go to the dentist once a month. I don't really want to go twice a year, but, like, twice a year is an acceptable amount. So anyway, nacho dinner ruined by a rabbit. I thought today, I mean, it's darkness. I think one of the keys to life is to wake up either, okay, if you're a person who's just a morning person who wakes up before dawn, then go for it. But if you're not, if you're, like, not an early morning person, I think limiting the number of times you wake up and it's still dark outside is like a key to life happiness. I just think that the person who rarely wakes up before it's light out is going to be happier and better off.
I really think that like sleep is a... This year, I've discovered...
This last probably 3 months even. Like how good sleep is for a person. I know that doesn't sound very... That's not a big revelation. Like, helpful snowman, helpful tip of the week. Sleep makes you better. Sleep is better for you than not sleep. Which is like no shit, but... I don't know, I feel a lot better when I sleep more. I've been reducing the amount of coffee I drink as a issue for addressing my bowels that we all know and love. And like reducing the amount of coffee makes me a lot sleepier, a lot earlier. Like I'm sleepy all day, so that's kind of shitty, but then I've kind of been discovering like, well, you're partially sleepy all day because you're used to having coffee. You're partially sleepy all day because you should be sleeping more than like 7 hours a night or 5 hours a night or whatever. So there you go. Hot tip, huh? But I thought that tonight/today, I wanted to talk about... I had this idea for a column at Lit Reactor and then I ended up not going with it. Because I pitched 4 and they took 3, which is usually what happens. And the one that I pitched was, something about Flannery O'Connor, because it's her birthday next month. And she's got an unfinished manuscript for a novel that somebody is like working on right now, some kind of scholar type person who's also a writer is finishing. It's some lady. I don't know much about her. I think that's sort of interesting, but I think it's sort of stupid also. I mean, Flannery O'Connor has an awful lot of material out there. I've got like a complete stories of Flannery O'Connor. It's not a slim volume by any stretch of the imagination. So I don't know why we particularly need this other novel, and I'm not a huge fan of the idea of like somebody finishing someone else's novel for publication. I guess if you just wanted to do that because you're just crazy, go for it. It's a little how I feel about like translations, you know? It's like it depends so much on the translator that you're like, I don't know, for all I know, this translator is adding so much to Murakami's work that, like, he would not be popular in the United States or whatever. Because you translate it, right? But you're also adding style to it. Like, you can't help it. And you wonder, like, is he kind of taking something that's appealing to Japanese people and changing it for American audiences? Or is it just a straight-up translation that's as true as possible? And how true is the translation from Japanese to English? Like, how close is it? You have to restructure the entire sentence. So it makes me wonder. It makes me wonder for, like, a fairly artistic writer. Like, when I was Skyping with Tom, I remember I went to his workshop and he said this thing that always stuck with me because he was talking about sentences and words and like the importance of not just plot, but like he said that he took a poetry class when he was getting his master's degree, and like the teacher was saying that what's great about poetry is in prose, like fiction writing, every word is basically holding up a sign that says don't pay attention to me, stories that way. You know, and they're just, every word is kind of designed to propel you along the story as opposed to being something of its own, as opposed to being something to enjoy as you go. It's more just like the words are utilitarian and they get you where you need to go rather than being a thing of beauty themselves. And he heard this from this poetry teacher and was like, Well, that it doesn't have to be that way. You know what I mean? We could choose to not do it that way. And that always stuck with me a lot. So, you know, we could be more careful with that. We could do better. Fuck. I can't remember why I started talking about the words as individuals and all that shit. Oh, Flannery O'Connor. So to tie it all back to that, someone's finishing one of her novels, and I have very mixed feelings about that. It turns out she was also kind of a weirdo, which I liked. I mean, she was kind of like she was single. There's like one sort of written report of one time when someone kissed her, which is probably her only kiss as an adult for sure. And you know, the person describes it in very unflattering terms. I mean, it sounds like he was like kissing a corpse, basically, was the sensation experience, which is really too bad. It's kind of weird because, I guess it's weird because on the one hand, I'm like, yeah, I mean, you don't have to fucking be married and all that shit. Like, who cares? But on the other hand, it is unusual. I want to say that. And that's part of the line that I was walking and working on the column, right? Is I'm like, listen, I'm not saying Flannery O'Connor is bad because she's like never been kissed or whatever and was unmarried and all that shit. But it's very unusual. And I think it throws a lot into question because it's kind of like, I think a lot of our great writers, you know, we talk about how they've experienced things and those experiences come into their work, right? But like, if you've never actually had sex with somebody, what does that do to your fiction writing? You know what I mean? Maybe it's not important, is something that we're learning from Flannery O'Connor. Like, maybe it doesn't matter. But if that doesn't matter, then what does matter? You know what I mean? Like, then you gotta question, well, does any of this shit really matter? I mean, probably not. I know that's a revelation. Nothing really matters. But I don't know, you could probably write a lot of shit without experiencing everything or coming at it from a different angle. I mean, it can be an advantage, I think, to be an outsider in some ways. She drank coffee with Coca-Cola in it, which I thought was really weird. And I remembered there was like several years ago that was like a canned product you could buy. It was like coffee and Coke together or something,
which I was like, maybe this is the Flannery O'Connor special.
Maybe this is like a Southern thing. I don't know. I don't know. She's also like a very religious person, even though her stories weren't necessarily heavily religious. She's a very interesting person. She was also very frank about how she felt about other people's work. Like, you know, she would just straight up say, like, I don't know, I don't really care for, like, Truman Capote's shit. I don't think it's very good. Or a couple other, like, famous people. And contemporaries, too, not just, like, dead old people. It's not like, Virgil's work wasn't really that great. Because you're like, I mean, what's he gonna do?
So she was unusual that way, too, where she was just kind of, she was quite a smack talker.
It's like somebody in the NBA, man, talking shit. I was hearing about this documentary about a basketball team. And one of the things they would do is kind of like, they took trash talk to a new level by researching their opponents. And they would find out things like, what was this guy called when he was in elementary school? When like kids on the playground were making fun of him? Because then they would have that in their arsenal when they went to play him. Isn't that kind of fucked up? I mean, it is kind of fucked up. I don't have to ask. I'm telling you it was fucked up. But, interesting. So anyway, with the time we've got left, I wanted to talk about, I had three other pitches still. Trying to remember. I'm trying to remember, but I only remember one really well. And the one that I really remember is, I pitched, so in Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck, there's this asshole ranch hand guy. He's kind of the antagonist in the story. And throughout the story, he's wearing a glove full of Vaseline. Now, this is like briefly mentioned in the book. And I think it's just mentioned like one time. Because he's wearing like one glove and this guy is like, oh yeah, that's his glove full of Vaseline. He likes to keep his hand soft for his woman. And I was totally obsessed with this as, you know, an eighth grader. Because I was like, what? He wants to keep his hand soft for his woman. And I think I know why now. I think being in this workshop the last month has led me to a new theory on why that stuck in my craw. And it's because the glove full of Vaseline is like Chekhov's gun. So, you know, you put a gun in a drawer at the beginning of the play. People forget about it, and then it comes out at the end. And you're like, ah, shit. I knew that was there, but I kind of forgot. And a well-used object, sir. This is kind of the opposite, because there's no payoff to the glove full of Vaseline. You don't see him put it on. You don't see his woman, like, rubbing his hand like, oh, Curly, your hand is so soft. I think it was Curly. You don't see any of that shit. So that, I think that, like, frustrated me as a narrative before I even really knew what was going on. Because I was like, hey, you put this fucking thing in there, but there's no payoff to it. Like, where's the payoff? And you put such a weird thing in there, too. It's like having a box full of dynamite that you're like, Grandpa moved in at home because he's, like, got Alzheimer's. And, you know, we as the reader see him sliding a box full of dynamite under his bed. I wrote this story, like, a long time ago called This Is a Hand Grenade. And basically, it's like, the whole premise of the story is this guy lives in this neighborhood and there's an HOA and they're giving him a lot of shit about this like lantern he's supposed to have on the front walk of his driveway. So he gets the lantern and then he takes the pin out of a grenade and puts it inside the lantern so that basically it would be difficult to get it out of there without blowing up the grenade. His kind of protest, beat the system act. And I wish, I don't really reread that kind of stuff because it's so old and I just like, I'm done with it. But I seem to remember the story was very focused on this hand grenade. Where was it? How did it get there? It's not like a surprise that he's got a hand grenade. You're not like, wait, what the fuck? Where did he get a hand grenade? What's it? It's not designed to surprise you. It's very much about, isn't it crazy that, like, what if you introduce a hand grenade into a sort of basic suburban environment? Wouldn't that be strange? Wouldn't it be strange if there was grenades? The answer is yes, it would be. So anyway, it's kind of all about this object, right? Like, it's more my memory of it. Or if I wrote it today, it would be very based in that object as opposed to plot. It's not like plot, 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 plot. It's basically like set up and then the object carries the story for the most part. So the glove was like this object that's in it. It's super unusual. And that's the whole thing, right? It's like that box of dynamite or a grenade or like, you know, if somebody, like Chekhov's gun, if someone at the beginning of a movie, like a Wes Anderson movie, walked out to the desk at the Hotel Transylvania or whatever that place is called, Grand Budapest Hotel, if they walked out to the desk, cocked a gun, and stuck it in a drawer, you'd be like, okay, if I never see this again, what would happen? You know what I mean? What does that do? There's like a story in there somewhere, or like a short comedic thing or something of like called, you know, the unpaid setups or the unfinished payoffs. You know what I mean? And it's like, you could even have it in the form of like a letter from a loan company that's like, we loaned you the story capital that allowed you to have a rocket launcher in this guy's garage, but you never paid it off, and now we're coming for you to pay the fiddler. You know, we need our story investment back. There's something there. Anyway. So the column idea that I pitched was about, what if I wore a glove full of Vaseline for like a week? Because I was like, I looked up online to see, like, was this a common practice? Like, what's going on here? And I found nothing. And you know what? As an eighth grader, and then as an adult also, you know what it should have been? Is it should have been like, Curly's wife did not need to be there. In my memory, I may have to reread Of Mice and Men, which I'm not really looking forward to, but whatever. But, I think the payoff should have been that his wife wasn't there and he was using it to jerk off. Right? Because that makes sense. If you're a ranch hand's wife and you're like, I don't want your hands to be disgusting and hard. It's like, well, he could just wear gloves. I don't know what the Vaseline is doing, A. B, I don't know what your expectation is as a ranch hand's wife, but like, you may have an unreasonable expectation at play here. C, why one hand? Like, why is it like, oh, well, if that, or, you know, he could have been touching her face or touching his own face while he's jerking off or something. I mean, something. Let's pay off this unusual item, right? Don't just throw that in there. Don't just throw it in my lap and not throw it into his lap later, is what I'm asking for. So the column idea is that I'd wear a glove full of Vaseline, because really, it seems like most of the world is not as interested in this as I am, maybe because it doesn't really go anywhere. And that's the thing, I'm going to have to confirm this does in fact not really go anywhere. It does in fact not pay off. It doesn't really do anything.
And so,
you know, it's the gun in the drawer that never was fired. And so, it hasn't been the subject of a lot of scholarly research, let's call it. And that's frustrating to me. And I intend to change that. I intend to see that that has changed. I don't know. I just think there's something there. And because other people don't seem to have written about it, I'm curious. Now, I had some coworkers who were like, oh, this is a terrible idea. And I was like, why? And, you know, one of them was like, what if it gets infected or something? And I was like, I don't think it's going to get infected. And we had an argument because, you know, she was talking about bacteria and stuff. And I was like, well, where am I going to pick that up that I'm not getting it already? B, I'm going to have a glove on, so won't my hand be less susceptible to bacteria than it was before? And also, I think most bacteria is aerobic, right? So it requires air, and I think that Vaseline is like anaerobic. I don't think air is passing in and out. So it's like, I think it's going to be fine, but also, what am I going to do? Like, just put it on and everything feels fine? And then, I mean, I'm going to have to take it off at various times. I'm not going to wear it in the shower. I'm going to try and simulate what Curly would have done, which is, I assume, wear it like 8 hours a day. I assume he's not wearing it when he's home, because, like, if he's wearing it to keep his hands soft for his woman, but then he's just always got this fucking glove on, could he have fucked the glove? I mean, something. Ugh. Just, why not a scene of him putting the glove on and the Vaseline is squeezing out at the wrist? That would have just been so vile. And how much Vaseline, you know, when they say a glove full of Vaseline, that makes me think, you know, you kind of like Maybe you heat up the Vaseline and liquefy it and fill up a glove with it. Like fucking Howie Mandel did with the top half of his face back in the day. That was his big bit. Before he was bald and his bit was like judging talent. So that's one of the columns. I don't know. It was funny because I think it was met with surprising resistance from a couple coworkers who I told about this idea, which made me all the more interested and invested in doing it, of course, because that's who I am. But also, I think I felt like, I think you guys are wrong. Like, I think you're looking at this from a health perspective, and I think that I will be able to wear a glove full of Vaseline. I mean, I know there are people out there who use Vaseline as, like, lotion on their bodies frequently. Now, they probably don't put a glove on top of it. And, you know, one of them was like, well, how about, could you wear, like, a rubber glove instead of, like, a leather glove or whatever? And I was like, I could, but what difference does that make? And it's like, well, you know, it'll be more sterile or whatever. And I was like, I don't know, I think it'll just be more sweaty. I think it'll be just as gross. So glove full of Vaseline is in there. There's one other one. So there's a day, you know, there's like this book that we used to have at the library, and basically it was like, what should we make a display for this month? Is what I would call the book. I can't remember what it's called, but it's, some book, it's the, you know, the da-da-da-da book of events. And it would tell you about, like, worldwide events for, like, every day of the year. And, you know, a lot of it was bullshit. I mean, we were talking about Valentine's Day before, right? And how that's made-up bullshit. And I'm like, if you think that's made-up bullshit, you know, National Jeans Day? National Donut Day? I mean, come on. At least Valentine's Day is ostensibly, like, emotional. Or related to a human emotion, as opposed to being like, you know, go buy and consume a donut, which is not good for you, not really going to make you feel better. Probably just, you know, filler to deny our emptiness of our lives. Ugh, dark. So one of the days in March, though, is like National Make Up Your Own Holiday Day or something like that. So I decided I'm going to make a list of holidays, like literary holidays that we don't have, but we totally should. So that's going to be a thing. So that'll be fun. That's going to be that one. You know, I try and do some that are serious and some for funsies. And Flannery O'Connor's kind of my serious. Glove Full of Vaseline is also not very serious. And then, this one's pure funsies. So the one that I pitched, but that's not happening, was basically what I've learned from a writing workshop that helps you in the business world. And I pitched it because I thought, you know, this could have some online appeal to, like, business crowd, right? In addition to writing crowd. And it's also kind of attacks this idea of sort of the learning an art is worthless, right? It doesn't have practical application. And I guess it attacks that idea because it kind of says, yes, it does. And here's some of the things you learn. Because I've found that participating in various workshop situations has really made me different from a lot of my coworkers in a lot of ways. But since it's not happening, I thought we could just talk about it, even though we're, like, getting pretty close to the airport already. But let's give it a shot. All right. I think number one is you learn how to take feedback. And you learn that the way to take feedback is to take the feedback, consider the source, and then make a decision a little bit later. Right, so if I've got a great idea that I'm pitching at work, and I have 10 people in the room with me who are giving me feedback on the idea, I've seen a lot at work, you know, someone will bring an idea and it's their baby to them, which I understand on the level of, yeah, I mean, like, I brought a story to workshop last week, and I'd put 25, 30 hours into it. You know, it's 10 double-spaced pages at the rate of, like, 2 hours per page. It's like I was saying before, you know, trying to pay attention to the words and the sentences and all that stuff. And, you know, changing around the order of a sentence, even though it contains the same words, to make it sound correct. To make it sound like the way this person would talk. So a lot of work goes into it. And it's, you know, it comes from the sore spot, right? That's one of Tom's things, is like right from the sore spot. And it totally does. So it's personal. It's a lot of work. And then you got to kind of bring it to all these folks who are going to, well, you know, the perception is like you bring it to these people and they tear it apart. And it's like, well, that's not really what they're doing, but that's beside the point. The point I'm trying to make here is that people do this at work. They bring a new plan for something. They bring a new structure for something. And then when people critique it, they just get mad or they defend it. And I think that those are the worst ways in which to address criticism of your work. And it doesn't matter what your work is. I think that's like a terrible way to come at it. Because when you're defensive, you're not really listening to what someone else is saying. You're not allowing for other people to tell you the truth. If you're someone who gets that sort of reputation at work of being a defensive individual about your ideas, people stop critiquing your ideas, which is, I guess, kind of what you want, but your ideas aren't going to be as good. You know, they're not going to be as refined. They're going to sound like an individual just kind of came up with this idea all on their own, because that is what happened. You're not taking advantage of the fact that you're not alone at work, you know? So I think that's a big thing. And, you know, when you're at work too, it's kind of like, it's even more important to take that criticism and hear it, because I might be designing a system that has to be used by 50 other people, right? So it needs to kind of work for them. I mean, if I'm just writing a short story, it's my choice. And in the end of the day, it's my choice whether or not I take people's criticism. And whether or not I incorporate it into a new draft or whatever. It's all my choice. But when it comes to something at work, it's not just my choice. Because other people have to use this too. So it's not... It's really important to get that criticism and listen to it. And that's the other thing, is I think a good technique for not getting defensive that you learn in a workshop is, like, you bring a thing into workshop and you just let people say what they're going to say. And you just sort of let it happen. And then sit back and think about it for like a week. You know, like what I did last time is I got all of my notes and I wrote crazy notes when people were talking. And then I sort of consolidated them into a list of things that, you know, I took all the things out of it that I was like, this person probably has a point, or I don't know, maybe I need to look into that further, right? And just made it this sort of concise, bulleted list of concepts, ideas, whatever. Because then I could put it aside and I'm not going to forget anything important, but I don't really have to think about it in a, like, you can't, I don't know, I don't think you just want to sit there and look at the list and be like, yes, no, yes. And, you know, doing some things on the list necessarily means not doing other things on the list. But I think that's a really important factor. And something that most of us are bad at on some level, and the people that I'm really bad at working with are the ones who are really bad at this. Who I'm thinking of, there's a particular coworker I've worked with a few times, and what she'll do is she kind of like, I compare it to, she's like in a fucking tower, like the guy in a Nightmare Before Christmas making the doll woman. And then she brings down her completed work and it's like, this is my masterpiece. And then there are some issues with it, and most of those issues have something to do with, okay, well, I know what your weakness is in your planning, which is like, I think that you have this ideal version of what the world looks like, and that most of us don't live in that same world. And therefore, when your ideas emerge, they're not very realistic. Like, what you're asking people to accomplish and what you're asking them to do with their time isn't super realistic. And so that's a big problem. And then when you tell her that, she gets very upset. You know, this is a person who's known to cry at meetings and doesn't actually change anything. And so you kind of, I mean, someone else I worked with who's very nice kind of said, are you bringing this for feedback or are you just telling us this is how it is? Because it seems like you're getting upset that I'm giving you feedback here. And if you're just here to tell us what it is and be like, this is what it is and that's how it is, that's fine. But, you know, I should know that, right? So, that's number one. And that's like a big one. Just like, you got to learn to take criticism. And you got to learn, kind of segueing from that, how to not take things personally. And that's like one of those easy to say, hard to do things, right? But my kind of personal advice on that, as far as like how to not take things so personally, is like, you got to recognize that the people you're working with aren't trying to like sabotage you. They're not trying to make your life worse. They're not. Most people, this is like a sad thing that goes into a motivational thing, I think, or a positive thing. People don't really care about you. And so that sounds bad, but what I mean is people aren't waking up in the morning thinking like, how can I ruin Pete's day today? What can I do to fuck with him today? I mean, maybe there's someone out there who's got me on their list of enemies, like fucking Richard Nixon, but I doubt it. And if so, it's not a lot of people. And you know, if I am on that list for you, let's have your sweet revenge and then, you know, call it a day. Not just slowly grind my life into a terrible hellscape. But anyway, like, people aren't trying to do that. And I do believe that. Like, and the reason I believe that isn't because I'm like, people are great. It's because I'm like, I don't know, people are mostly lazy. And if people are mostly lazy, I think they'd rather come to work, do some shit, screw around for a little while, and go home. Like, that's what most people would rather do. Most people are not trying to take on a job and a half and be like, well, I work 50-hour weeks because I'm devoting 8 hours a week to fucking with this other person and making their life miserable. And that's the thing, too. People don't come to a workshop to tear your work down. They don't come to a workshop to like, well, I love making people feel like shit. Now, part of the reality here is I'm talking about the majority. Are there individuals who are like that and maybe unaware? Oh, totally. 100%. Are there individuals who are like negative? Are there individuals who are awful? Absolutely.
But, you know, you can't treat the world like you treat those individuals.
So anyway, people, when they come to talk about your piece in a workshop, they're trying to help you. They're trying to use whatever skills they have and whatever ideas they have to make your work better. Not to, like, make you miserable. So you gotta, like, recognize that. And you have to understand that on a deep, deep level. That, like, you know, these other folks are here to help me, not to make things worse. And if I think they're here to make things worse, I'm making it worse for myself. Because I just... That's silly. That's a silly thing to think. It just is. It's like a silly thing to think that. And it's counterproductive. You know, I just touched on it, but one of the other things you learn in a workshop is, like, there are certain people who don't go by these like rules and values, right? There are some people who don't share your common rules and values and ideas. And those are people that it's like, don't worry about it. Like when you're in a room with them in a meeting, let them give their feedback too. But you know that there are some individuals who you have to take their feedback with a grain of salt. You have to just say, you know, this guy is always saying, I think these two characters should kiss. You know, I want to know about this person's dad. And you're like, this has nothing to do with that. I mean, anyway, there's always going to be that person. And just accept it and just sort of be like, you know, this is one person who thinks this and they're not correct. And so I shouldn't invest a lot of time worrying about what that person thinks. And I shouldn't let it get to me. And also should, you know, count on some other people to share their opinion, right? Something else I learned specifically in this workshop is that, like, when you're sharing ideas about stuff, and I see this a lot at work. When you're sharing ideas about stuff, and so someone shares idea A about what you're doing, and someone else shares idea B, the way that we should do it is people should go around the room, make their comments, but not crosstalk. And by that I mean, if I'm the third person to talk, I don't have to talk about what person number one and number two said. I don't have to address what they said and say, well, I agree with what person one said about this, but disagree about this. As far as number two, I agree with this and disagree about this. People, I think, should just kind of share their opinion on stuff. But not, they don't need to share their opinion on the other opinions. I might think somebody's totally wrong, but that's fine. Like, the person who brought the idea, the person who brought the piece, can make that decision. If they ask about it, of course you can tell them. If they seem to be taking this piece of advice very seriously, or, you know, giving it a lot of weight, and you think that's a mistake, you can find other ways to talk to them about it and maybe say, like, hey, I wanted to check in with you because I feel differently. And I don't know how expressed that was, but anyway. I think a big thing you learn in a workshop is to not waste other people's time. We waste a lot of time in meetings. And by we, I mean the world. Like, we come unprepared. You know, we've all been there. You email everyone the materials for a meeting. Everyone shows up. No one's read the shit. And you're like, motherfuckers, why would I bother sending you this shit if you didn't need to read it? And like, whenever I've kind of hosted a team, when I've led a team, if I send them stuff that they need to go over before the meeting, I make that pretty explicitly clear. And you shouldn't have to do that in a workplace, but I guess you do. I mean, obviously you do, because I do. But I will tell them in no uncertain terms, like, you need to cover this material before you arrive, because we have an hour to meet, and in order to accomplish what we need to accomplish, we can't be sitting there going over the stuff that I've sent you a week in advance. Like, that can't happen. And I think in a workshop, you learn about what a waste of time it is. Like, and you feel bad about wasting talented people's time. If you go to workshop and you bring something that, you know, you didn't really work that hard on, or if you were in the kind of workshop where you were supposed to read before you got there, someone else's piece, and come up with your sort of comments and critiques, you're going to feel like shit if you haven't done that. And it's your responsibility to do that. So I think that's another thing, is like, just, you need to value other people's time in at work. And that's something I think I've taken from workshop. I think that, I don't know. I think there's just a sort of toughness that comes from workshopping. It's sort of like I've experienced this thing, this crucible where I've laid myself bare and heard some unvarnished opinions on it. And like, you know, I'm okay. Like, I'm fine. It's sort of, I'm trying to remember who was saying this. I think it was Roz Chast was kind of saying, like, you know, drew this cartoon and it's basically two people at an art museum and they're looking at a piece of art and someone's like, I don't like this. And then she's saying, like, and what happens then? She's like, the art still exists. The art is not altered by this person's opinion about not liking it. Like, you know, and the artist kind of stands there and, like, touches their own body and is like, oh, hey, I'm still alive. I'm okay. Someone didn't like my thing. And, you know, the world has continued to spin on the same axis. So I think you can, I think that's a really valuable thing, too, is just like, hey, it's okay for people. If people think your idea is total garbage, you know, go out, have a beer, figure it out, and, you know, think about it. And it's fine. It's like, you're going to be fine. You're not going to be, you know, the workshop doesn't end and we're like, well, it's a fucking Hunger Games situation and we kill the person with the worst idea or the worst story. So you're like, oh my God, everyone's trying to outwrite each other. If you make that same mistake that you're constantly making, then the penalty is death. I mean, there's nothing like that. There's nothing remotely like that. So I don't know. I think that's like a good thing to take too from a workshop. I think that another thing that I take from a workshop that would be really useful in the world of work is if you don't want to hear people's honest opinions, don't bring something to workshop. Like, if you kind of feel that this is good and there's nothing you want to change about it, don't bring it to workshop. Because, like, if you do that, that's why people get defensive, right? That's why people get argumentative. Is because they feel like what they've done is really good and, you know, perfect-ish. And there have been times in different workshops where I kind of want to ask the person, like, well, why did you bring this here if you don't want to hear anything about it? You know, we're being nice about it. We're not being assholes. But if you didn't want to hear that there might be some issues, you shouldn't have brought this. Like, you should not have brought this with you to workshop if you didn't want to hear about ways it could be improved. I think also something I've learned in workshop is that there are things that can be done in workshop and there are things that have to be done alone. And so, like, even a collaborative project has alone elements and has group elements. And it has elements that aren't really best accomplished by everyone in the room together. I'll give you an example at my work. You know, we're doing this outcomes-based stuff, right? So you have to come up with outcomes for different programs or services or whatever. And it's like, you know, I don't know, if I'm doing a resume class, it's like attendees will use the skills learned in resume class to find employment in the next 3 months or something like that. Right? That's just like an example of a completely made up outcome. But sometimes we waste a lot of time in meetings because we like wordsmith these outcomes to perfection. You know what I mean? Like, it's going to be the fucking holy Bible that we go by, this outcome, and exactly as it has been foreseen by this group, you know, down to the letter. And that makes me, I hate it. Like, I hate it. I sit there and I'm often asked for help on this because people know, like, people are like, oh, you're pretty good at, like, expressing things in words and being concise and, you know, whatever. And but I have, like, no passion. I got no patience. And I hate waiting when it comes to that. I just think that that's not work that has to be done by eight people sitting around a table perfecting these two sentences. That just seems silly to me. And also, it's like, I don't know, can we just make a... Nobody's going to see that. Nobody's going to see the unfinished version. It's not like every program that has an outcome, we put up this giant poster that tells everyone the outcome, right? These are available online for staff. Like, I could look at someone else's outcomes for their program. So it helps. But it doesn't really matter to me if it's worded perfectly, is what I'm getting at. And the time that we spend wording it perfectly in there is like, listen, I'm someone who understands the importance and meaning of words, and I feel like that's a waste of time. Because this is like me writing a grocery list and thinking like, well, how does this sound to the ear if broccoli is on there before cauliflower? I mean, on the one hand, I kind of like that it's broccoli cauliflower, so that's BC, so that's alphabetical, so there's something about that. But on the other hand, maybe it's good to mix it up with a non-3-syllable word in there. Or, you know, and do I say broccoli as 3 or do I say broccoli as 2? Because then maybe it's all right. See what I'm saying? Like, that is not time well spent, in my opinion. It's not time well spent to consider how you're writing your grocery list and whether or not, you know, because we could do it. We could do it all fucking day. And would we get a better grocery list? Absolutely. But is that better grocery list really going to do anything for us? I don't think so. I don't think so. Kevin McAllister. I don't think so. I think also, you know, we're at the airport, so I'll just say like a last thing. I think that being in a workshop provides an opportunity to do something that's really valuable, which is, I think people need to get used to having an outlet other than work. I think it's really important for people to have something in their lives that's more important to them than their job. And, you know, I think this is like why, for example, people seem to be happier at work, like if they have a baby, you know what I mean? This is and why having a baby can sometimes, I think, make people feel like, oh, you know what? This work thing that I'm really frustrated about is not that important. Because, frankly, I like getting out of the house. Is kind of a break for me in some ways. I think that working with adults can be rewarding in a way that maybe, you know, being at home all the time isn't. I'm not up to my elbows in fecal matter. I mean, I am at my job, so it's not really a break. But I guess you'd be like, oh, it's a different person's fecal matter. You know, variety is the spice of life. So that's something, I guess. But, I think that's why it's just really crucial to have something in your life, beyond your job. Now, if you're like a career person, you know what I mean? If you're just like, I fucking love my job and I love doing the tasks of my job. Like, that's where I find my happiness. I guess that's all right then, right? I guess it's cool. But I don't think that's the case for most of us. I mean, I think there are lots of us who are like, I like my, you know, my job, but what we mean is I like my office, or I like the place I work, or I like the people I work with, you know what I mean? But I don't think a ton of us go into work and just feel like, I love sitting here and like going through this spreadsheet. Like, this fulfills something in my brain. I don't think that that's the case for most of us. And that's fine. I think that we're kind of made to feel a little guilty about that in some way from time to time. I don't know why we do that to each other. Like, I think we make it feel like you're lucky to have a job. And so you're so lucky to have a job that therefore you should love your job. And if you don't love your job, you should, you know, abandon it and let someone else do it. And, you know, I don't believe that. I feel like you should at work feel like, well, I'm glad I have a job, but also they're lucky to have me as well. So I just think it's a good idea to have something else in your life, because then you kind of get away from this guilt, you get away from these feelings, and you kind of, you just have more perspective on what is and isn't important and what is and isn't worth making a fuss over. All right, well, I'm at the airport and I gotta go. But thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.